Brian?
Good morning, friends. The scripture reading this morning is from Genesis chapter 28. And I'm going to read verses 10 to 19-ish, and then I might read the rest, more of the chapter a little bit later. But it's on page 37 in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament version, part of the Pew Bible, if you want to follow along. Genesis chapter 28, verses 10 to 19. Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went towards Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. He called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. All right, with that, we'll let the kids go. Is there a place where you have come especially close to the presence of God, or I should say perhaps where the presence of God has come especially close to you? Because that's what happens in this story. The presence of God comes especially close to Jacob. He has what I think of as an altar-worthy experience here in this place, which, at least to begin with, sounds like no place in particular. Do you have an experience that you remember that was altar-worthy? In my experience, there isn't one place that I return to again and again, at least in terms of physical location. I think some of us are like that, that there is a particular physical location that we always come back to, that where something really important happened for us spiritually, where Christ spoke to our lives in a way that we did not expect. I find for me, especially after having lived for many years among faithful people, that it's not so much place for me that I remember as where something really significant happened, but it's community. It's the group of people that I was in the midst of. But spiritual experience is often solitary, and certainly Jacob's experience here is a solitary one, although it carries with it the promise of community. It carries with it a promise for community. But at this point, it's just him and the Lord in this altar-worthy experience. One of the things that Jan Wood shared with us, Giuseppe and Stanley and others of us that were at Stoking the Fire the week before last, maybe it's been 3 weeks since I've been back. It's all kind of blurring and blending together here, folks, I'm sorry. But one of the things that Jan reminded us of the importance of in her her sharing on trusting God and giving ourselves over to God's trust entirely was the importance of commemoration. The importance of commemoration. The importance of setting up marker stones when something really significant has happened as a way to remember what that was, whether that is in a particular physical place or whether with a particular community or in some other way. The importance of taking the time to commemorate what God has done in our lives. And that's something that I don't often tend to do. I can remember events in my life as I've journeyed closer and closer in this journey with Christ, gone deeper and deeper into the reign of God. I can remember particular events, but I don't have any particular commemorations. I don't have any marker stones set up. So that may be one of the things that that Jan's words challenged me to try doing. An altar-worthy experience. To begin with, as I said, this is not really a special place, at least as far as the passage describes it. Jacob comes to a certain place and spends the night there because the sun had set. It's pretty much time to go to sleep. You can't go anywhere when it's dark, so it's time to lie down. And we don't have the sense that he's chosen this spot any more than it's the place where things got dark. He doesn't select this place by any criteria other than it's where he was at sundown. And he doesn't have any preparation other than find a stone and put your head on it. Probably not very comfortable. So perhaps God has guided him to this place unaware. But it's simply the place where he lies down. And he doesn't recognize that there's anything special. We might ask, what are the things that keep him from realizing the presence of God at this point? If you think about Jacob's story, most of you know the story, I think. He is the just barely second born of twins, right? Esau comes out of the womb, but Jacob's holding onto his heel, you know, pulling him back. And that pulling back your brother is kind of emblematic of the first part of Jacob's life. He tricks Esau into selling his birthright for a mess of pottage, as it says in the King James Version, for a savory stew that Jacob has prepared. And then he puts on Esau's hairy clothing, that his mother gives him, so that he will get the blessing from his father that is supposed to be Esau's as the firstborn. So he betrays his brother in this and probably other ways that the story doesn't document for us. And at this point in the story, he's received this blessing by deception, and he knows he's betrayed his brother, and he basically needs to get out of town. And so his father has sent him on a quest to find a wife to a far country that he does not know. So he's leaving home for the unknown. And one commentator points out that Jacob thus far has pretty much been a homebody, right? He's kind of a what in some sectors would be called a mama's boy. He's been kind of protected by his mother. And it's his brother, Esau, who is the sort of outdoorsy, rugged type, who would put his, you know, who would have no problem sleeping on a stone. But Jacob, perhaps not so much. A big part of what's going on in this story is God reiterating the promise, remaking the promise that God makes to Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, which we looked at last week in Genesis 15. God actually reiterates the promise numerous times to Abraham. But here he reiterates it to Jacob, two generations later. And so if you think about what we talked about in last week's message, the story shows us Jacob choosing God's future for himself. In the same way that Abram, when God brings him outside and shows him the stars and says, so will your descendants be. And that's the point at which we said last week, Abram chooses God's future for himself. He doesn't choose the future that he can see. He chooses the future that God can see. This is a moment like that for Jacob as well. A moment of trust, a moment of putting his faith in what God can see and not relying upon what he can see. This is a point when his conniving has got him into trouble. He's been sent from his home, everything that he knows in pursuit of what must have seemed like a distant and uncertain goal. God steps in to reaffirm the promise and to give Jacob the option to choose a different future for himself and all of his descendants. But backing up a little, there's this peculiar vision of the ladder or the stairway. It's translated, it's actually the word that's used here for ladder only shows up in this passage in the Hebrew Bible, and it doesn't really have many parallels. So it could be translated a variety of ways. Some translations choose stairway, others choose ladder. And the angels ascending and descending. So one of the things to notice is, who is it that goes up and down the ladder and who doesn't? It's just the angels, as the text says. It's not Jacob. And there have been any one of a number, I mean, probably many more interpretations than we could count as to what that ladder means and what the significance of the angels descending and ascending and descending is. And just to throw out a few that various people have suggested, one suggestion is that the presence of the angels is a sign that angels will accompany Jacob. That both ascending and descending, both coming and going, angels will be with Jacob on this journey that he is making. Many people have looked at the ascent and descent part and interpreted that as the movement of prayer and God's response to prayer. As our prayers ascend, God responds with blessing or with rebuke sometimes, or with an answer that we didn't expect at all as the angels descend. That's another way that people have interpreted this passage. A while ago, Charles brought in a piece from a newsletter from one of his church music organizations, and there was a column that suggested that the ascent and descent is music, and the way that music helps us lift our hearts to God, and the way that God responds in worship. There are all sorts of ways that we can interpret the motion on that ladder. But there's another piece of it that I think is significant, which is where God is when God speaks. And this, again, relies upon the way that particular words are translated. Our Pew Bible says, "The Lord stood above it, above the ladder, and said, 'I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham,'" etc. And that's as we would expect. The top of the ladder is in heaven. That's where God is. That's where God speaks from, right? But think about the way that God has acted with Abram/Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, before this. We have the sense that in his encounters with Abram, God is much closer. God brings Abram outside to look at the stars as if they were both standing there together. And then in chapter 17 when, or no, I'm sorry, it's in chapter 15 when they formalize the covenant. The presence of God moves in through the halves of the animals that have been sacrificed. So even here in this vision, some interpreters translate the verse 13, rather than "and behold the Lord stood above it" as "and behold the Lord stood beside him," or "the Lord stood with him and said, 'I am the Lord your God.'" So it's possible that God is actually much closer in this place of presence and in this vision that Jacob has, depending on translation. Now, Jacob does not climb, and there are any one of a number of reasons for this as well. But one thing that I think relates here is a contrast that one commentator suggests with an earlier story in the book of Genesis, the story of the Tower of Babel, which again is a story that probably all of you know, where humanity prior to the calling of Abraham, prior to, it's the first thing that happens after the flood when humanity is trying to rebuild, they decide we're going to build this tower and it's going to go all the way to the heavens. And it will get us closer to God, and it will increase our status so that we are more like God. And God, of course, puts paid to this idea right away. So part of the story with the ladder is as a counter narrative to the Tower of Babel. Nobody's going up that ladder except for the angels. Jacob is not going up that ladder. Jacob is staying on earth where he belongs, we might suggest. So it's not only situating people, putting people in their place, unlike the Tower of Babel, but because the story of the Tower of Babel is put in Babylon, or what at the time of the writing of this history was Babylon, this is also the writers of the Hebrew Bible saying, the gate of the gods, what Jacob says, the gate of heaven is not in a place like Babylon. It's in Bethel. It's in our place. It's in a place in Canaan which God is giving to us. So the story is in part about where God's presence is situated and who God's presence is situated for. Hebrew faith, as we've seen, as we know from our reading of the Hebrew Scriptures, is very place-oriented. The temple in Jerusalem, the temple in Bethel, various other places of worship. And there's a lot of disagreement, actually, that we can see in the Hebrew Bible about where the proper place of worship is, where God's presence is truly going to be. So part of this story is about establishing the place where God's presence can truly be expected to be. Of course, for us as Christian Quakers, the story moves on and becomes more general and in some ways more complex. Resting upon Paul's words in the New Testament that God does not dwell in temples made of human hands, friends believe, and many other Christians like us believe that God, we can encounter God anywhere. And that we can know the presence of God in many different places and among many different communities of people. So this is not for us to say we know better, but simply to say that we know differently. And from our experience, we have experienced God in many different places. And that in fact, it can become a problem when we insist that God is only available in one particular place, or to one particular people, because we know that Christ works among all people in a variety of ways and in all places. So there's the question of place and of how that is important, or whether it's important to us in our walk with Jesus. But I think there are also times in our lives, and again, times that we might want to commemorate in ways that we haven't, perhaps, when God breaks through in the way that this story describes. Not because we are prepared for it, or because we have it all together, but precisely because we don't. God breaks through sometimes when we are not ready for it, when we are not looking for it, when we would rather be doing something else. But all that's required of us in that moment is to receive that gift, to open our eyes to see the vision, open our ears to hear the promise, open our arms to receive the gift that God has for us. And then once that is done, respond as Jacob does in worship and thankfulness and perhaps by commemorating what has happened for us here. But just as with Jacob, there are things in our own stories that keep us from realizing the presence of God. There are things that can obstruct us, perhaps things that we have done or things that we have not done that we regret, people that we have wronged that we have not been reconciled to, situations that we carry in our hearts that are unresolved in some way. These are all things that can keep us from realizing and saying with Jacob, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So a question for us to consider in open worship, which we will go into in just a minute, is what role does faith as trust, the kind of trust that Abram demonstrates, the kind of trust that Jacob demonstrates in his good moments, what role does faith as trust play in our being able to realize that presence of God, wherever we are, whoever we are with? How can we trust God more to be able to be more open to God's presence in those moments? And what are the things in our own stories that keep us from realizing that presence? Let's take these things into a time of open worship.